Hello and welcome to Our Dad's Died, the podcast of people whose dads have died, or, you know, maybe your mum's died, or a friend's died, or, you know, someone you know has died, someone important has died, or is just dead to you and you're feeling that loss. For anyone who's experienced a loss, it's for everyone, I keep saying, it's evergreen. As the ramble will suggest, Rich isn't here for the intro and outro this week. He's off doing stand-up comedy in Manchester. I know a lot of our listeners aren't based in the UK. London and Manchester are quite far apart. Not as far apart. I mean, if you're in America, it's in an insignificant distance. But in the UK, we consider a three-hour drive a big deal. Now, this week we've got a really, really funny comedian on called Carl Donnelly. He just did a show in Edinburgh at the Fringe Festival about the loss of his dad. Here he is. Great episode for you. Coming right now.
I came to see your show at the Soho Theatre, I think, was it like 3 days after your dad died?
No, it was, I think it was about 2 weeks.
Oh, was it? Yeah.
But yeah, it was because I tell you, it might have even been 3 weeks, because it was before the funeral, but it was after he died.
Yeah,
because I remember I've got a routine in the show I wrote about my dad dying, where I talk about those gigs at the Soho Theatre. Because on the first night, there was two nights.
Mm. Yeah.
On the first night, the Undertaker who I'd done all the admin with, was just sat in the front row. She hadn't told me she was coming. Like, we'd had a little chat when we were doing the admin. I was sat with her. I'd went in to meet her a couple of times to sort out the funeral. All the funeral arrangements were done, but because there was a big delay, because there was a backlog. And Lambeth Cemetery, where I wanted to do the cremation, was shut for refurbishment. So we had to do it in South London, in sort of Streatham Mitcham borders.
Right.
And so we did it, and there was a bit of a backlog. So it was all done, and I still had about 3 weeks till the funeral. And the first night of the two-night run at Soho, I went out, and she was the Undertaker lady was sat in the front row.
Jesus.
Like, and I remember, like, I talk about it in the show, like, part of me feels it was almost a bit unprofessional, even though she was lovely and it was fine. But part of me was like, I was looking forward to those gigs. I was using as a slight distraction from the background of what was going on, and then that was just an instant reminder of, oh no, you haven't even had his funeral yet.
Yeah, front row as well. In any circumstance, front row is bold. But
yeah,
if you're the Undertaker of this guy's dad's funeral,
I know,
imminent funeral,
just move back, sit back.
Presumably not dressed in the full gear, top hat.
Well, she was admin. She was the sort of one who did the organisation. Right, okay. So she was dressed mostly in sort of smart cash.
Right, right. Fair.
But it was a weird moment. But yeah, I didn't know you were there. Because I mentioned it on stage. I sort of felt like it'd be weird not to. Because it was so, everything that was going on at that point.
Well, I remember I think the exact words that you used were, because you were moving house at the same time or something.
My dad died the night before the move.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Which I think you described it as quite a spicy meatball. That's the exact phrase that you used.
Yeah, I don't remember saying that, but that does sound like something I would have described it as in what is one of the biggest understatements of all time.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a real rough sort of 8 week period of because my mum was also on the waiting list for a care placement through social services, because she's got Alzheimer's. So they were just about holding it together living alone. My dad was physically very ill but mentally sound. My mum was mentally very ill but physically sound.
Right.
They were living in the council flat that I grew up in Tooting, and we had carers going in pretty consistently throughout the day, and we had a private carer that we were paying for, and there was also, luckily, social services provided some regular carers as well to go in and do food and things. So it was like spinning plates for months, and probably for, you know, the best part of 2 years I was really like involved in all their care, and it was real my own stuff and my own kid, and like we just had a kid in 2020. So, and then my parents, both of their health just bottomed out, so it was all this sort of house of cards that I was somehow, like, I don't look back and think I was particularly stressed. There was times when I was stressed, you know, in days or moments, but I felt pretty like, I've got this, I'm sort of sorted. And then it just fell apart last July. My dad, out of the blue, just like, even though he'd been ill, and there was obviously, I thought he probably had 9 months to a year left in him.
Right.
And he just got rushed into hospital. He'd had a fall. Basically, he was so run down. He had a fall. My mum, because she's got dementia, she sort of found him but didn't really know what to do because her dementia just, again, bottomed out in the space of about a month.
Right.
And then the carer came, luckily, about half an hour later, called an ambulance, and then it just began from there. My dad went into hospital. He died 4 days later. We had to move in with my mum rather than move into the new place that we had the keys for. And then we had to spend, 6 weeks living with my mum while her care place came up. And I was doing the organisation of my dad's funeral. Mm-hmm. Then my mum went into care. And then I had to clear out their flats. It's a council flat. So literally the day I put her into care, social services called me and said I now had to give back their house. So it was just real. And it all just crumbled around. But at the same time, it was all so intense. There was so much to do that I'm sort of glad I managed to just get it all done in such a short time that some people have all that happen over about 5 years, don't they? And
yeah, I suppose it's in one way, it's good to get rid of it in one horrible go.
But yeah, and then in the middle of that, I was doing some gigs at the Soho Theatre that you were at. So, cheers for coming.
Yeah, no worries. I mean, that's a spicy meatball, certainly.
It is, yeah. That's what I mean. I suppose it was a real sort of, it was crazy how much was going on at the same time. Plus having a two-year-old as well who started to become a real sort of fun handful.
Yeah. Sounds like it was a real Dalmio day.
Yeah.
So there's something very odd about doing stand-up, it strikes me. I'm not a comedian, I'm out with this world, but it seems to me that basically everybody else in society, when a big life event like this happens, take your pick of some of the ones you were just naming there, they'll take time off of work.
Yeah.
You know, they'll, in my case, you know, oh, my dad's about to pass away. Right. Well, I'm off work. See you guys. That's me for 2 weeks. Or,
you know, you can take a bit of time off, you know, if you're financially sound. You know, I'm sort of, I'm not the best with money, but I've always been slightly, I used to be so bad with money, but about 10 years ago, somebody recommended that I get a financial advisor, which I got one that's really affordable. Like over the year, it doesn't cost much at all. It'd be like way less than like a gym membership over the course of the year, really. But that guy just set up like things like an ISA and things that I don't even know how to access. So it means that I've got like a little bit of money goes out of my accounts each month. And it means I've got enough just somehow, even though I always feel like I'm skint, I've got enough money some in places that like if I need to take a month off, I can. You know what I mean? So I did manage to take a bit of time off. Like, you know, but part of it is I really like gigging and I don't mind gigging when I'm in a bit of a fragile state. And because, like I said, I actually dealt with all of it like very stoically and philosophically. And I felt like I've had times before, like I went through a divorce a decade ago. And after that, I took 2 months off and traveled around India like a walking cliche. But that felt like a time where I needed more time off than this time. Like I felt like this time, you know, I actually didn't mind gigging. It was quite a nice welcome distraction from it. So it just depends where your head's at. I think like some people, I think some people do gig through periods when they shouldn't, you know. I think you can tell. I've seen people gigging where I'm like, yeah, you should still be off, you know what I mean? But I think if anyone would have seen me last year, they would have been like, oh, he seems all right considering.
I guess it didn't, by the sounds of it, come as like a huge shock. Like you said, it all sort of went downhill quite quickly, but had you had time to sort of come to terms with that this was going to happen at some point?
Yeah. Well, I think it's a mix of things as well. Like I'm very, death doesn't particularly trouble me as a concept. I'm not somebody, you know, in my personal terms, like, you know, I'm not somebody who's, I've got a friend who's like got a pathological fear of death. It's really interesting. My mate Trev, like he couldn't come and see my show in Edinburgh because he couldn't be in the same room as my dad's ashes. And I had my dad's ashes in the center of the room, and I played it in the round ashes, which was, I found it really fun. One guy, when I said that the ashes were in the room, did run for the door and not come back.
Really?
Wow. He must have had the similar thing to my mate Trev, like a proper, some people just have this pathological fear of death.
Yeah.
And some people have like, some people just ignore it and they don't even think about it. And then when it happens, it really catches them off guard when a family member goes. I've always been quite interested in like philosophy and like even some of the ones like Buddhism and that, where, you know, you do have to slightly, acknowledge that it is going to happen to everyone, including yourself. So
yeah,
I think I've always had it. It is a thought that crossed my mind a lot. Even before my parents were ill, I'd always be aware that they are going to die one day, and preferably before me. That's the way it should work.
Yeah.
So I think I've always been relatively prepared for it. And then once they both got ill, you know, my dad's health was so bad. Like, physically, he was so bad for especially the last 6 months. He had this thing called COPD, which is like a degenerative lung disease that you can't really fix, isn't it? Because it's almost like a catch-all phrase. It's like, it's not like a cancer, or it's just your lungs are old and packing up, and so there's no one particular thing. So they just call it COPD, essentially, in some cases, sort of like IBS for your lungs. But, his quality of life was so bad that ultimately I was quite relieved when he finally wasn't suffering anymore. Mm. So it was that helped. And actually, like, to be honest, like, because I knew his trajectory and that, like, it was only going to end one way, I've in the last sort of 3 or 4 years, I've been much more concerned about my mum's condition, because that is one that is such a lottery and is changeable day by day and deteriorates in different ways. And it's much sadder to watch somebody, you know, you sort of understand when people get old and physically frail and smaller and. But yeah, watching your mum just physically, like mentally disappears is very hard, and sort of I find that a lot more of a challenge to sort of, you know, keep that stoic head on than I did with my dad.
And is your mum's still around?
She is, yeah. She went into care in sort of mid to late August last year. So my dad died on July 15th. My mum went into care, I think it was exactly 6 weeks after he went in. And after he went in, that's what I call it. After he went into
heaven.
Yeah, after he went into the great void. And I heard somebody once refer to that, and it really made me laugh. They said, "We lost my dad this year to death." It's like, I thought it's a really funny way of describing it.
Technically correct, but
it is. Yeah, yeah, it's actually spot on. So yeah, so my mum's now in care, and in the last year, she's deteriorated a lot more, and she can't really. She's still there. Like, I can sometimes, like, especially in summer, it's been quite nice taking her out to the gardens of the care home, and we sit there and I bring a little bottle of rosé, and like, she can sit and be very, she's much more serene than she was for a couple of years before going in and before my dad passed away. But she just can't really have a conversation. She can't really, she starts a sentence and her ability to finish it is gone. Like, so she, it would just sort of peter out, and she doesn't really know what she was trying to say. So it sort of is, weird. It's quite a tricky thing to just, you really have to carry the conversation, if I'm honest.
Yeah.
Yeah, they could try a bit harder, couldn't they?
I know, come on, man. I'm working so hard here.
I was just going to ask about the ashes, really, because you sort of mentioned them in passing, that they were in the room at one point. I was just wondering, it's sort of a bit of a time for a rousing game of Where's Your Dad?
He's literally just here out of shot. Oh, I'll show you if you want. Look at this.
Please.
It's the first on-camera dad.
this is where he's been since I got him. Since he went in.
Since he went in. Well, he went into the end,
When he came back out, they asked me to collect him. And I went and collected him. Here he is, look. Can you see that?
Oh, he's in his box.
There he is, John Donnelly. And the date of cremation. He actually did the service was on the 15th of August, but they actually didn't bloody burn him for 2 days. They got a bit lazy. It's really heavy. Have you held one of these?
My dad's
cremations. Yeah. Shockingly heavy. I don't like when I went to collect them, I was really like shocked. I talk about it in the show. Like, the woman handed it to me. My dad was little. Like, he was little when he was healthy. Yeah. He was 5'7". He was quite he used to box when he was young, and he was a bit of a whippet of a man. And like, even he never really got like a middle aged spread or anything. He was always, he might have had a tiny belly, but he was always really slender and wore lovely suits. And, you know, and then he got really ill. And, you know, for 2 years being super ill when you're in your 80s, like, you waste away. So by the time he passed away, he was like a wafer. So when they gave me that, I was like, I said to him, "What is going on here?" I said, like, "Why is it so heavy?" And the woman then said, she went, "Oh, well, you know, we don't just burn the body. We obviously burn the coffin and everything they're wearing. And I said to her, I went, I didn't really want all that, if I'm honest. Like, I wasn't that attached to my dad's shoes, you know what I mean? So, yeah, in the show, I talk about how I think it's a bit rude that they don't run it. They should give you the option. Do you want 100% pure...
Uncut dad.
Yeah. Do you want some moody Camden knockoff dad?
But then I guess it's equally weird at the funeral home to be like, and could you, this sounds weird, could you burn him naked? I want him out of the coffin.
Yeah.
Nude.
It's what he would have wanted. My dad was a creep. Is this what he would have wanted?
Do you think the problem though is that if you were to do that, it would be the opposite problem, wouldn't it? In that they would hand you him in a sort of, you know, dime
tiny
bag
little.
Almost.
Yeah.
There you are.
Your dad's coke can. Yeah, I don't know, I would have preferred it just to be legit all him. I don't know. It feels a bit like, yeah. You know. But then, yeah, so I came, when I picked it up, I brought him home and then I just didn't know what to do with it. Like, there's nowhere, he was one of the least sentimental people on earth, my dad. He was really funny and deadpan and like, but he had no sentimentality. Like, I never saw him take a photo, never saw him. Like, there was not a single place on earth that he was super fond of. Like, he liked whatever, but he was very simple and didn't have any hobbies. So there was nowhere to like scatter him. So I've just got him there and I've never put him in an urn because that feels a bit decorative and weird for me, so I've just kept him in the box and I took him up to Edinburgh for a little jaunt, and like, he's just, I don't really know, I'm just going to leave him there for a while and just work out what to do next, I think.
Yeah,
this was going to be my question, is that obviously typically what I think what would happen is they might get put in an urn, and obviously you've stuck with the box, but as you said, he didn't have any hobbies.
No, not a single hobby.
What do you mean, though? But what did he do with this
time?
Nothing
at all. Like, my dad, like, I mean, my parents both were like Irish boozy, fun people, but like, they didn't have any hobbies at all. Like, my dad, I suppose, no, he used to, but in the last 15, 20 years of his life, he had none really. Like, he used to like go to the horse racing and he used to like to gamble, but he got all that out of his system after like him and my mum split up for a bit when I was in my teens. And because of his, like, of his, what you would say were hobbies, became more problematic.
Going down and, the bookies.
Bookies, drinking, like, he just, you know, he's smoking 60 a day at one point. And, like, he, like, really went a bit too far with it all. So my parents broke up. And I ended up living with him back in Tooting. And my mum also, she had, like, lifelong mental health problems. So there was a period where she sort of had to just take herself away for, like, 6 months and sort of work it all out. So me and my dad my brother was 7 years older, so he'd pissed off. So me and my dad, who was basically a recovering alcoholic, but not really, never really stopped drinking, but he just managed to somehow get a lid on it and just wind it right back to being able to go out once a week and have a few pints. But and then after that, he sort of gave up everything. Like, he still smoked, but not as much. And then he just didn't really gamble. Like, I don't know, he just became this incredibly simple, like, bloke who just sort of watched telly, go out once a week for a beer, read the paper, and that was it. Not a single other pastime or interest. It was amazing. Like, it was almost like he'd achieved enlightenment in that he just was so unattached to any of this worldly nonsense.
I don't want to undercut your dad's Siddhartha Gautama level of enlightenment. However, there is something to be said about you trying to surreptitiously scatter his ashes at a William Hill.
Because he'd give it up again, that would be rude. It almost like going back to the scene of the crime. And even like, this pub, like, there was one bar or that would have been the right place, but it shut like about a decade ago. So, you know, it's weird. There's like, and all the pubs like he used to drink in are now swanky gastro pubs, so they've lost there's nothing really to do with him other than just keep him, and I'll just work it out down the line.
Yeah, I mean, there's no sort of, that's the annoying thing, is that my dad's buried, so I didn't have the problem, but they give you this box and it's like, this is incredibly important to you, but it is just a box, and that's yours now, so do what you want with it. And you're not allowed to, I think, Tom, you said before, you're not allowed to scatter ashes on private property or something.
Is that true?
You can't it sort of goes without saying in a way that you can't scatter ashes on private land without the landowner's permission.
Oh, yeah.
So you can't, for example, just go into Marwell Zoo, my dad's favourite place in the world, really, buy his bench for him there. You can't go to that bench and just scatter some of his ashes. I mean, you can't do that.
When you say you can't, I mean, technically, by letter of law, you can't. It would be illegal.
By letter of law, I'm sure Marwell Zoo wouldn't be very happy.
They're not really going to make you try and catch them and put them back in the box.
Oh, well, I mean, listen,
my dad also had a bit of a criminal background, so I did catch that off him. I would just commit the crime and then be like, what do you want me to do? What, are you going to sweep him up?
You know, I'm an upstanding member of society here. I've got a real job in the public sector. I'm telling you, there's no way. You can't do that without the landowner's permission. You just can't, you know.
Crucially, what you're saying is you can't, but you're not saying that you didn't.
Well, I'm not saying that nobody's saying that I did. I'm saying that you can't without the landowner's permission. It's as simple as that.
That is the official line that we will stick to. Excellent.
As simple as that. And you certainly can't do it in a Ladbrokes. I'm telling you what, though. Can you imagine it'd be a good bit?
There is that. I mean, I did. I considered, making something. You know, you see these, you make these weird things out of them, you can make jewellery out of it. It's like, but then he never wore jewellery. Anything I think of doing with them, I think he'd have not been into that. So, ultimately, what he would have done with them is he would have put them somewhere and forgotten they were there. So I think I'm going to do that.
Yeah, it sounds like
honour his memory.
Fitting thing you could do.
Or lack thereof.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Just put them in a cupboard and forget they exist.
Yeah, it sounds perfect. And how has it been since? So it's been a year or so now.
Yeah, it's been oddly, after everything settled down, I cleared out their flat. My mum was in care. I got back to normal super quick. And I've definitely thought I'm fine with everything. There's not a single, I'm not going to have this delayed sort of reaction, or I'm not going to suddenly get really maudlin down the line and think I've not dealt with stuff. But I would say I did definitely have a bit of a, not a wobble's the wrong word, but just I reckon I had a month or so around the time it was coming up to the year of it all happening, mm-hmm. where it wasn't something that was playing on my mind. It wasn't like a conscious feeling of or memory or this is, I don't know what it was, but I just felt like I went into a bit of a funk for about a month, that it was almost like a residual, I've just got to get this all out of me. But it also could have been the fact that it was coming around to me doing the show again, because I did the show in Australia. The show that I did about it, weirdly, I did a few previews in January in London, but then I went to Australia for 3 months and I worked it up there. So I went to Adelaide and did 5 nights at the Adelaide Fringe of previews, where each night I changed it and was getting the show together. Then I did a whole month of it in Melbourne at the Melbourne Comedy Festival. Then I did it in Sydney Comedy Festival. And so the show was like... The show didn't take it really out of me or anything, because I was working it up. I was excited about trying to write a new show, even though it was about something sad. But also I was doing it on the other side of the world. So I weirdly didn't have the impact on me that I think some people thought it might. I often would get asked, is it taking it out of you talking about your dad dying every night? And I was like, no, it's like, I've actually kept it really light. And it's more about death and the surrounding admin and loads of stuff you have to do around it that you don't think about until you're going through it. But then coming back here, and once I started previewing it here and then going up to Edinburgh with it, I think it's because I moved. I was moving to be near my parents to help out with their care even more. And then obviously my dad passed away and my mum went into care within a matter of weeks. But then I still now live. So the place we've moved to is like a 5-minute walk from my parents. So I walk past my parents' old flat probably sometimes 4 times a day.
Yeah,
I walk past every pub that my dad used to drink in. I walk past my old school. I walk past so many memories constantly that I think once I got back here and it was a year later and I was doing the show and I had this constant surrounding of memories and my mum had deteriorated when I got back from Australia, I think that just all got on me and I was like, oh yeah, it is actually quite sad, isn't it? Everything that happened. Whereas I think up to that point, I'd just been blissfully... just on the go a bit, and didn't really have time to just sit with it since it happened.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess if you're talking about it every day, you're thinking about it, but without ever, like, you're just trying to find ways to make it funny. You're not sitting there and actually reflecting on it and stuff.
And I do think there is that. I don't think I'd really prepped for doing it every day while being basically in the area where it all happened, you know, walking past, going past St. George's Hospital all the time where my dad died. And like, there were so many places where it all was like, it all took place. So it was like, suddenly I'm doing the show every day and thinking about it every single day because I have to, because I'm writing a show and doing a show. But also I'm literally at the scene of the crime. So yeah, I think that just got on top of me, and it took me about a month to, I'd say it was only probably, a few weeks ago, coming back from Edinburgh, and I was like, all right, I think I've got it out of my system now, because I'm probably just going to do the show once or twice more. I might do a little preview, and then I'm going to film it. Yeah. Although mentally, I've decided I'm going to film it in the pub where I had his wake, which was over the road from where I grew up, the flat I grew up in. So you can literally see it from the room I'll be doing the gig. If you look out the window, I'll be able to see my parents' old flat. It's a mad idea that I've now hatched, that I've decided I'm going to do, and probably just cry for an hour on stage. It's a pub that I literally used to go in with my parents, and so that's why I had his wake there. So I'm doing it in the room where the wake was, over a year after. It's all feels like a sort of exorcism, I think. I'll do that, and then I'm like, I'm never saying these words again.
Yeah, fair. And were you there, like, so he died in St. George's in hospital. Were you, like, with him when he died?
I was, yeah. I was at the moment of death. I was really? I was with him. Yeah. Wow. Because he was so unwell. And so, like, he was in for 4 days. And the first couple of days, they had him on everything, and they were stabilizing him. And, you know, it was, but it was clear he wasn't going to get better after day three. So that's day three, they started winding things down. And day four, they just took him off all the machines and just let it just sort of happen.
Yeah. Was he conscious?
No, not at all. It was first day he was in, he was a bit, you know, in and out of consciousness. Second day, he had a couple of moments when I was with him where he sort of woke up and just said some mad shit. he'd say stuff from, it must be some sort of life flashing in front of your eyes, because he'd say things from, he'd asked me how somebody was who died 30 years ago, you know, like, he was like, how are they? And I was like, well, yeah, I think they're all right, actually.
Yeah.
But
nothing new with them.
Yeah. No, stay same. But
do you recall what his last words were?
Not really.
If you had to
again, because it was that thing, because it was going every, I it might have been that. It was, I can't remember who it was. It was someone about Mary Dempsey, who was an old, there was John Dempsey, Mary Dempsey were like their friends, and they had kids who were like my brother's age. So there was just a local Irish family that were friends. So he asked something about them. How are they? And I'm like, I'm pretty sure either they're both dead or one of them's dead and the other one moved back to Ireland. So I think that was his last words. But that was on like day two. Day three, he was totally out of it. And just quiet, very peaceful. There was no stress, it was very nice and peaceful, but there was still a lot of beeps and hospital noises. Day four, total silence. They turned everything off and just put a radio on in his room, which they put Radio 3 on, which was quite creepy because obviously it's all classical. And there was moments when I'd go to get a coffee, because I sat with him pretty much all day that day, as I did most days. But on the fourth day, I sat with him on the last day, and sometimes I'd go get a coffee. I started smoking a bit because I was like, I hadn't smoked for years, but I just, the stress meant I suddenly picked up and bought a pack of fags just to try and give me something to do. So I'd nip out and have a fag. And then when I'd come back in, like Mozart's Requiem would be on Radio 3. And I was like, oh, this is a bad sign. And then, he was there. And it was about, I left my mum with my aunt, because I was like, she doesn't need to be at the hospital. It was a bit too stressful for her.
Yeah.
And then it was probably about 7:30. It's a bit of a hippie thing, but I felt like it was, I felt something sort of shift in the room. There was no change in my dad, but I suddenly just got this sort of eerie sense that he was going to go very soon. So I called my aunt and said, can you bring mum back up? I think it's quite soon. And they came back up. They got there about 7:30. Actually, it ended up taking 2 more hours, but he died at 9:30. And it was pretty so it's fucking intense to watch somebody take their last breath, especially, obviously it's your dad and that, but like I talk about it in the show actually, I literally do observational comedy about the last 2 hours of his life. But there was quite a few false alarms because obviously he was just breathing very slowly. Because they took him off all the beeps, there was nothing to let us know that he died when he did. You know what I mean? So we had to just watch him like a hawk to try and catch his last breath. So there was a few times where he did one of them big like film breaths where it was like, and then it, like the pause was long enough that I was like, oh, he's gone. And then he'd be like, I'd be like, ah. Ooh, I missed it. And that was for a couple of hours. And then it was about 9:30. He just properly just did. It was like, it is like a film. Like he took a big final breath and that was it. Just slow out. And that was the end. And it was like, it was so big. Like it feels so massive to be part of that. And like, I'm not a crier. You know, I didn't think I'd cry. I was 100% confident I wouldn't cry when my dad died. I thought I was going to be all stoic and be sad. But I've never been a big crier. You know, I'm somebody who's very sort of stoic and not in the sort of unemotional sense. I can get emotional. I cry at films. I cry at stuff. But about real life, I'm always like, no, this is not the time for crying. This is the time for just dealing with what's happening. Yeah. And, but I honestly cried like so viscerally. Looking back, it's like it almost makes me laugh that it was like being a baby. It erupted out of me, and I had this sort of 10 minutes, like primal. Like I had to take myself off to sort myself out. It was brutal. Like felt like wow. It came from my guts. Like real, you know. It was because I'd not really. I suppose the whole time they were ill, and I was. I've done so much to help them try and navigate that period of their life.
Mm.
At no point did I ever cry or no point did I ever sort of get really sad. So I was stressed at times. It got me down, but I always just maintained my head. And like, it was almost like that. It was the end point of that. And it was like, these 3 years, whatever, of emotion came out. But yeah. it lasted like 10 minutes. It was like a tap going on. And then... pulled myself together, went into the bathroom, had a look in the mirror, sort of got myself together, stopped crying. And then, because there was no machines on him, I had to sort of pull myself together to go and break the news of his death to the staff at the hospital, which isn't exactly the right way around. So I was all, you know, I was all messed up and teary. And I went out and found a couple of nurses and sort of said, excuse me, ladies. And they were like having a tea break. And I went, I'm sorry to inform you that John Donnelly's passed away. it was a mad night. And then, we sat with him for about half an hour before a doctor came in. They said, oh, we'll send a doctor to just come and explain what happens next. So we just sat with him for half an hour. And obviously we were all sad. And my aunt and my mum were crying. And then the doctor came in and then we did the chat and sat with him for a tiny bit more. And then we went home and like... It was that night, weirdly, was quite, we had a really fun, like, hour or two when we got back to the house. Because by that then, my mum was still able to sort of navigate a conversation. And she was always super, charismatic and fun, my mum. She was a real party person. And, like, so was my aunt. And we went and bought some wine and just went and sat and... In the living room and just drank wine and sort of told stories and like it was, we were laughing and we were really good, like it was an amazing few hours and I got really pissed and at about 2 a.m. I went to sleep and then my alarm went off at 7 because I had to pick up a van to start moving so that was
Jesus.
So it was a real like get back to the grind man, none of this emotion now, you've got to go and pick up loads of boxes.
Yeah, you got like a brief couple of hours where you're allowed to emotionally react to this enormous news. And then it's like, now drive a van, please.
Yeah, 15 minutes of crying, 2 hours of reminiscing. Now get in the van.
Was that when, like, after your big cry, the immediate big cry, did you cry again afterwards?
No, never. No, it was like I got it out of me, and there was sad moments, and at the funeral I was sad, but I didn't cry at the funeral, and I did the eulogy, and I genuinely feel like that was the big, that's what I had to get out of me, like this sort of, and then I've got back to my normal stoic ways and just sort of got on with it, and then I suppose I didn't really have a chance, you know, then it was all hands on deck to look after my mum and work out how she's gonna be safe and secure. And yeah, so it was, I just had to get on with that.
It was the most efficient way of doing it. You've got so efficient, you were like, right, now's the time, get all of the tears done in a 10-minute window. And then,
yeah, I put my crying in my iCal these days. Just got an alarm that goes off and says, quick, 2 minutes of crying, 2 minutes of primal screaming, and then get back to your life.
It's weird how that happens, though, because I had a similar thing where, like, the night that my dad died, I had one big cry. I didn't cry when I got there. It was like very sudden, so it was quite a shock.
Then
I didn't cry for a bit, and I went to the loo and I cried like hard.
Yeah,
did like a real big one for about 5 minutes, then went back out, and then I didn't cry for months. And then one day, probably like 3 months after he died, I lived in Doncaster at the time. I was just in my flat, and something sort of made me think of him, and I started crying.
Right,
and it was this weird thing where it was like the sort of the physical need to cry overtook the actual emotion of it. So after 10 minutes of crying, emotionally I was fine. I've like, oh, I've done that. But my body was like, no, you need to, there's more tears to come. And yes. So I had stuff to do. So I was just like walking around my flat, tidying up, hoovering, but like
hoovering, crying. Sobbing.
But I felt fine. I felt really good. But my face was just still sobbing.
Yeah.
Really weird.
Function at that point. Up or running nose almost. It's just, this is just to keep happening. Going.
I suppose I did. I went to see a play. It's not a play. It's more of an immersive piece of theatre in Edinburgh called Funeral. And I went on my own because my wife had recommended it to me. And
like a triggering type of thing to pick.
And what's amazing was after I'd seen it, because my wife went up to Edinburgh the week before I did, because I went up for the last week. She went up the week before for a few days on her own just to see some shows, and she had a bit of work on up there. And so she went up there and she saw a bunch of shows and she recommended that. And obviously I knew it was going to be about or something around funerals and death. But like, when I came out of it, she was like, are you okay? And I was like, well, you know, obviously, it was very emotional and there was tears. And I wasn't big crying, but I definitely had like tears in my eyes. And I mean, they were probably related to my dad. Like when I say I've not cried since, I imagine they were somewhat, related to my dad's death.
Yeah.
But like the way she said it, like, oh, you're right. Were you all right? Was it hard? It was like, well, yeah, it was. Yeah. But like, yeah, you could have given me a bit more of a heads up, like just recommending the show and then afterwards being like, how was that for you? It's like, fucking hard, mate. It was like, you're in it. You it's by this Scandinavian theatre company who do quite challenging theatre shows. And you don't realise it, but when you go in, you suddenly become part of a funeral ceremony and you end up on the stage, everyone partaking in this crazy Scandinavian funeral ceremony where you obviously can't help but feel like you're doing it for your own loss and grief, and like it's pretty hard going. So I definitely shed a few tears then
afterwards
for a few hours. And also that was the night of my first night of my show. That was the opening night of my show.
What?
So I went to see that and 5 hours later was doing my first night. So I spent about 3 hours after it being like, that was not the right thing to see when I'm about to try and do an hour of knockabout comedy about my dad's death and funeral.
I feel like a lot of people could have advised you not to see that show just for the name alone prior to...
But it was brilliant. It was also definitely, I'm glad I saw it because it was a fantastic show and amazingly created. Mm. So it was worth seeing, but I probably should have seen it the day or 2 days after.
Yeah, I feel like I'm often here to represent the part of the audience who don't have emotional reactions to life. And, since their dad or family member has passed, they're like me and they just haven't had a big cry. They haven't had a big unloading as you both had. But they do have what you just described there, seeing some form of popular culture. And that's the outlet. And having to, there's no penciling in a cry, but from time to time, there is certainly a, let's just watch Toy Story 2. And we'll get to the bit where Jesse gets left, when somebody loved me. and just get the tears out that way. And then the scene ends.
So you have to convince yourself you're not crying about what you're really crying about.
you can pretend it's all about Toy Story.
What you're saying is you're lying to yourself.
Listen. There's a whole group of people that are lying to themselves. And I'm just here to represent.
you need Robin Williams from Good Will Hunting to give you a hug and tell you it's not your fault until you finally let it out. Just keep repeating it.
Yeah, indeed. That's what we're doing. We're representing that. But that is a bold call, seeing such a risk to take.
This video is mad.
But you do get fascinated with that stuff, I think, after somebody dies. Like, I'd always go, and if someone said, do you want to go and see an immersive Scandinavian theatre piece called Funeral, I'd be like, yeah, of course. Yeah, that's right up my street.
Yeah.
Because I think for a while afterwards, you do get sort of, you like you said, like some people just never think about death. And then it happens, it's like, oh, it's sort of all you think about then for a while. Yeah. But not necessarily like in a scared or morbid way, just like, it's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. And also, even like sort of, I never really couldn't get away from it really, like in the sense of the moment everything settled down late last year, my mum was in care, I'd cleared that flat, you know, I was now, and then I sort of finally we got to unpack. Like, we didn't get to unpack properly our place until like October, even though technically we're meant to move in July. And so October happened, we settled in, and suddenly had a few weeks of feeling like semi normal. And then November came and I suddenly was like, right, I've got to start writing a show. So I started writing the show. And then one thing I always do, it's a weird tradition I've always had with writing shows, is one of the first things I start, the moment I start writing ideas down on paper or in my notes on my phone, every idea that I'd have just goes somewhere and I start collating it. And I always start putting like a playlist, like a Spotify playlist together of songs that are something that makes me think of something, or, you know, just related songs. So naturally, the first Spotify playlist that I started listening to when I was writing the show was the playlist from The Wake that I put together of sort of all these Irish songs that my dad liked. So suddenly it had all died down. I thought I was back to normality, or I could put it behind me sort of, but then pretty much everywhere I went and everywhere I walked, I was listening to the music from my dad's Wake for about 4 months. And then obviously I started putting together the playlist, but people come into the show, so that's on in the background, and that was songs from The Wake. And like, so I don't think I ever really got away from it. So yeah, so I did sort of, I suppose I was almost obsessed with it to a certain degree.
Yeah, I mean, you had a year-long Wake, essentially.
Pretty much. Just... And that's also probably why I went into that month-long funk, you know, June, July it must have been, where I was back and I wasn't obsessing about the show because it was ready. I didn't have to work on it much before Edinburgh. I was just popping up and doing some, you know, previews here and there. I was thinking about it, but sometimes it might have even been the first time I wasn't just spending all my days listening to my dad's Wake playlist and... So it was just, I could just walk around the streets where I grew up and just have to actually experience reality.
Yeah. Yeah. How was The Wake?
It was great. Like, you know, it was my dad had quite a small, it was a very small funeral. Again, by the nature of his age and, you know, a lot of people have died that he would have been his friends and family. He's got very few family members left. And same on my mum's side. There's not many people really. So it was a very small little funeral, you know, and The Wake probably had like 30 of us just sort of in a pub, you know, little functions room out back of the pub. And, you know, I put a big photo montage that was just on a big screen in the background and all Irish music. And we just sat around and drank and ate food. And that was, you know, from about, I can't remember what time the funeral was. Was it 3? Yeah, it was 3. And we got back to The Wake for about 4:30. And, you know, it thinned out about 8 or 9. You know, most people went apart from me and a few mates. And then the hardcore ones of us just went bananas. Like, you know, we went to a pub, we ended up in a lock-in, another pub that was. And then me and one mate ended up back at mine till God knows what time, sat around my kitchen table, just smoking cigarettes out the window and talking shite.
Yeah. So I mean, it sounds pretty fun.
Yeah, it was a nice day and evening. Like the funeral, yeah, it was all very simple. And my dad wasn't religious, so, you know, like he had, you know, he'd go to church now and again with my mum over the years, just because he sort of felt like he should. And, you know, he was sort of part of the parish, even though he didn't care. He obviously didn't believe any of it. He thought it was all nonsense, but he never would have said that outright. So we did a you know, a non-religious cremation.
Yeah.
So it was quick as anything. Bloody hell. I went to 2 funerals recently that were Catholic masses, full Catholic mass funerals, 90 minutes each of them.
Yeah, that's too long.
So long. Oh, yeah, and they were both during that really, like, you know, big hot stretch. Yeah, yeah,
perfect.
Jesus.
Did they do the sort of the Catholic thing, the sort of, well, I can't remember the term for it now, but the showing off of the body in the coffin, the house, you know.
No, they didn't do that, but just no, the coffin's right front and center, and like it's a full mass with all the added bits. So a mass is normally 45 minutes to an hour, so it's everything on top of that. And there's a nice bit where the priest walks around with frankincense in an orb and shakes the frankincense smoke over the body, like, the coffin, all the way around. It's quite a nice ceremonial moment.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
If you were when you die, I say if you die, when you die, yes. Death comes to us all. what smell would you like to be shaken over your body?
I do like frankincense. I've always liked frankincense. I don't know if it's a childhood regression thing about when I was, you know, made to go to mass for most of my childhood. But yeah, a bit of frankincense, bit of what else would be nice? Bit of lavender. Nice bit of something relaxing. The lavender would do me.
Lavender for the big sleep.
Exactly. Really put me out for the
sleepy time.
Yeah.
I don't actually know what frankincense smells like.
It's quite a strong smell, but you'd only really smell it if you'd have gone in churches. I don't know anywhere else I've smelled it. I bought some now. I've got a bag of it somewhere. Like it's almost like little crystal stones. And you can buy it in incense if you want, but I've got the actual stones, and you put them on a little charcoal burning disc. It's all weird.
Nice.
Yeah. I'd probably go salt and vinegar, personally. Nice. It's a really nice tang.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Just so everyone could go, oh, yeah, that's lovely, isn't it? Love some Pringles, you know? Something like that, you know? Just a nice, rich, lovely, what smell are you going for?
Yeah.
Your final smell is ultimately the question. What do you want your final smell to be?
Yeah, I think it would be Paco Rabanne.
Millions. What's Millionaire? Which is the one that's always on?
I think it reminds me of being in nightclub toilets when I was like 19, and you give a man £2 and he sprays such a huge amount of Paco Rabanne on you that you smell of it for.
I always remember CK1 was like that was the only time I ever used CK1 was in club toilets.
Yeah. It's the only appropriate time. Yup.
Do you remember Yup? Is that Yup?
Oh, was that Jupe?
Oh, Jupe, okay.
Yeah.
I didn't know if you meant to pronounce it. I thought it was a soft J.
Yup.
It probably is Yup. Yup. But I think in Kidderminster, it was always called Jupe.
Jupe, yeah. Yeah.
I remember thinking that was the ultimate smell, because my friend at school, Sophie, worked in B&Q, and she said that whenever someone came to the tills and they were wearing Jupe, she immediately fancied them. So I was like, I'm gonna wear Jupe, and I'm gonna go to B&Q.
Bathe in it.
Exactly.
I mean, it's a secondary question, but you have broached what's the ultimate smell. I mean, you know, it's not death themed, but it is a big question that could be answered.
What's the best smell?
Well, you just said it's the ultimate smell.
You did say ultimate smell.
Did I say ultimate smell?
Oh, I mean, yeah. Ultimate smell is huge.
For me, it's Yoop.
Yeah.
The ultimate smell. Oh, I don't know.
It's a big question.
It's really big.
We on the we had an episode we recorded on my wedding day. My dad left me a bag of kind of some of his stuff. Well, I guess he didn't leave it. My stepmom did, but this is sort of one of his bags with some of his stuff in it. Anyway, we opened it up and had a whiff, and it smelled of my dad.
Oh, really?
Which is really lovely, wasn't it? So I think maybe the ultimate smell in a weird way is sort of a familial comfort smell, isn't it?
Yeah. My dad always wore a nice aftershave. I think I got that from him. I'm a big fan of a nice aftershave.
Yeah,
nice scent, and yeah, he was always impeccably turned out, and smelt really good. Wore lovely shoes, loved a Cuban heel, my dad. So I think I always remember, yeah, the smell of like a nice crisp leather shoe. Even though I can't wear leather, I'm bloody vegan, but like there are certain dry cleaning. He'd always get his suits dry cleaned. The smell of dry cleaning is always a nice dry cleaners. Yeah, loads. I suppose there's loads of ones like that. He loved the hairspray because he had similar style hair to me now, weirdly, like something that, and then yeah, so I suppose I remember like hairsprays, nice aftershaves. Mm. Yeah, good smells.
Lovely.
It's weird, the smells, because the smell that always reminds me of my dad was mints.
Mints.
He was a bit of
lamb. You're a vegan. He wasn't.
No, it was the smell of treble extra strong mint, but covering the smell of cigarettes.
Right. Yeah,
He quit smoking allegedly when I think when my brother was born. But then he did smoke, and he thought, I think that if he smoked all day and then had one treble extra strong cover mint, then it'd be absolutely fine.
That'll cover up all the smell on your clothes and your fingers.
For some reason, that's the smell that always makes me think of my dad.
Yeah, yeah.
It's quite nice.
Yeah.
It's a good combo of smells as well, I think. Tobacco.
I love the smell. I love the smell of pubs. Like, we spent a lot of time in pubs growing up, you know, just socially, but then also we lived in a pub briefly for about 2 or 3 years. And then, yeah, it's just one of my favorite things is the smell of an old, proper old pub.
Yeah.
Just like, I love that sort of weird, foisty smell. So I find it really inviting.
Warm lager.
Yeah. Just the seats that haven't been cleaned in 50 years. That sort of thing. I love it.
And it's weird how those smells become like uniform as well. It's like a bin. No matter what you put in a bin, it always smells like a bin. Yeah. No matter what you've eaten, if you're sick, it smells of the same smell.
Yeah.
And pubs are like that.
Yeah.
I guess people just sort of average out over time and end up all smelling the same.
Well, it's sort of like black, isn't it? I suppose you mix all the colours together, that's where you end up, isn't it? Or white. I mean, I can't remember how colours
brown?
Work.
But... brown, isn't it?
If you mix brown.
Three solid colours, you get brown. And it doesn't matter what three they are. It's such a weird, isn't it? Weird like that?
Is that correct?
I believe so, works? Yeah.
All right, it's like brown is what I'm saying. And that is a better description for pubs in a way, really, isn't it? But they're a bit like brown. It feels right. A warm brown. That's what a pub is like. Yeah, lovely smell. So all right. So that's then. This is now as well then. How are you doing now? A big question, I know, but you know, how's things now? Do you think about your dad very much? You know, does it pop up?
Yeah. I mean, I do sort of, but I do think having got this summer out of the way, where I had that sort of weird regression and probably thought about it more than I had done at the time, even because I was so busy with other things, trying to work out my mum and everything, the move and all that. But I feel all right. Like, I feel like the last month or so, I finally feel very clear and okay about it all. And I can sort of think about him quite clearly about it being hard or troubling or, yeah. I think, again, having thought I was totally in the clear and then having a bit of a funky month, I'm not going to predict that I'm just fine now forever. I'm sure I'll have a little weird period at some point, something else will happen, or it'll probably be around when my mum passes away or something. Yeah, there'll be something will happen or cause it be like, oh no. But currently I'm mentally very sound about it, and I can just get on with finishing up the show. That's about it. I feel quite happy now to be like, oh right, I wrote a show that I'm really happy with and was proud of, and it got a fair bit about him and who he was, and you know, there was none of that negative. You know, it wasn't one of these shows that's about your issues with your parents. Or I've talked about that in the past. I've done shows in the past where I talked a bit about some of the issues that my parents had that I think fed into me, that could have been taken as quite critical of them, even though I didn't mean it that way. But this one was very much like, here's the good things about my dad, here's how he passed away, here's the admin and the rigmarole of death, and here's a little bit about the aftermath. And it's quite a nice story that I think people will probably be able to take away going, oh, right, actually, no matter how tricky things can get during a death, you will navigate it and be okay.
Yeah.
And I feel, yes, as of now, I'm literally get down to probably the last one or two times I'm doing the show. I feel so probably quite like now, yeah, it does. It's probably coincided with me being like, yeah, I'm all right, actually. I can now put that to bed and get on with my life.
Yeah. Well, so, you probably have thought about it more than most people do, because if you're writing an hour-long show about it.
Well, yeah, you do have to pour over every detail. And I didn't leave anything out of the show that, you know, the hardest bits that I talk about. Like, I talk about the moment that I got told he wasn't going to survive. You know, I talk about the moment of watching him take his last breath. Yeah, all the really big bits, talk about the aftermath and yeah, I feel like all the bits that you might probably be like, I don't want to think about that. I've, you know, not only thought about them, but I thought about them to the point where I've had to turn them into comedy. So, yeah, I feel probably like I've done enough musing.
With two people who listen, you know, who after someone's just passed away, so what would be the advice you would attempt to bestow upon them from your own experience?
Would probably be, based on that, would be, you know, you'll surprise yourself with how well you cope, considering, you know, sort of ultimately everyone goes through it, and everyone, no matter how hard you find it, you still get it done. You know, no one, I don't know a single person who hasn't had a funeral because their children just couldn't cope and do it. You know, I mean, ultimately everyone has pulled themselves together enough to do the admin, get have a funeral, see off there. But, you know, so it might, when it's all going on, it can feel too much, but when you look back on it, you'll be like, well, it wasn't too much because I did it. So
yeah,
my advice would be, try and keep a bit of that in your head when you're going through it and it feels too much. Just think, yeah, it feels a bit too much, but it's not too much because you're actually in the process of doing it. So try and step out yourself a bit and be like, oh, actually no, it's not too much because I've just called Vodafone to cancel my dad's phone contract. So I've done well, you know, every time you tick up a thing that feels horrible and hard, you're doing the thing that you think is too difficult.
Brilliant. Carl Donnelly, thank you so much for coming on the show. He has a podcast called TVI with him and Julian Dean, which is really entertaining, and I highly recommend you give a listen to after this. Why not? I mean, you've got to do something with your time. And you can also go at Carl Donnelly on Instagram, where you can see a bunch of stand-up clips that he's done, as well as his annual alcohol-fueled advent calendar for those who don't like drinking alcohol or who have recently been diagnosed with celiac disease like me, and now beer is a thing they can't partake of. Don't worry, you know, it's fine. I mean, me and Rich did, like, we used to drink lager whilst recording, we used to drink beer whilst recording these podcasts, and even on my wedding day, the morning of, we both had a can of Heineken, a type of beer, to celebrate the wedding, and now I'm not allowed it at all. You know, I just can't drink it, and it's a very strange thing. It's like, you know, much like Tom Ward and Carl Donnelly, I'm a vegan, and it's I gotta say, you know, to just start out as a vegan where the world's just like, you know, sorry, but you can't, you know, stop, you're not allowed to eat meat, or at least I'm like, you know, I'm not allowed to eat meat. I'm self-imposing this rule on me, I guess. I'm not allowed to eat meat. But then for the world to go, oh, not eating meat, are you? Well, bread's out now. What? Bread's out? What do you mean bread's out? Pasta too? No chance, mate. Oh, okay, but I can still have all the meat substitutes. Wouldn't have thought so. Most of them are made using wheat of some form. Great. Great. So that's just my life then. Good. My eyes all swollen up today as well, which just, so I've got lots to moan about. Oh, and my dad's dead. That's also another thing I have to moan about. Great episode with Carl this week again. I just wanted to say thank you one more time to him for coming along. He's got dates up on his Instagram if you want to go and see him live. He's a really funny guy. And if you want to see Rich live, just go on his Instagram as well. And if you want to see some fun little short little features we're making, a little bit, it's almost newsy in their sort of, you know, reporting on death-themed things. I'm popping a few of them together, and I'm going to be popping them on the Instagram as we go, as well as little clips from these episodes, as you know. So do please follow us at Our Dad Died, and if your dad has died, or if you've had a dream about your dad recently, even, I tell you, say your dad's alive, and you've had a dream about your dad that's a bit weird. I think I'll take one of them, and I'll see if I can analyse that to tell you when he's coming. To die. Something like that, anyway. At least I make myself laugh. Rich will be back next week. We'll be recording an episode together, which is going to be lots and lots of fun. We're very much looking forward to. And we have many, many, many more guests on the horizon as well, who are going to knock your socks off. We've got about five coming up. So very, very, it's going to be a long series, this one. Lots of good guests and hopefully lots to make you laugh. Just one last thing I wanted to touch on before we end the episode, relating to Carl Donnelly. He mentioned his dad and his ashes. And I have to say, if you have only just listened to this, it's really worth popping on the Instagram, because I don't think the audio alone does justice to a man producing his father in his hand midway through a podcast. Not something people normally can do. And, you know, I don't have ownership of my dad. You know, that he's not in my house. I haven't got that right to hang on to him. Who hangs on to the ashes is always an entertaining one as well. But there it is. Where is your dad? Always behind the camera in a box. He lives in a box. Thank you so much for listening this week. And do come back next week. We'll have another cracking episode. It'll just be me and Rich. And we'll be talking about something silly. Till next week, remember one thing and one thing only. Death comes for us all. Did you say the rest of it? See you next week. Bye.